Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. I just want to bring this to your attention. It is almost 2 months until the summer solstice. 2 months we have till the summer solstice. I think it's going to be freezing and cold until it turns 85, which will probably be in about a week. But anyway, we have an interesting show. April 14th is an interesting day in history. A lot of interesting things happened on April 14th. If any of you know or my Facebook friends or LinkedIn with me, I do This Day in Legal History, where I kind of track legal history that happens on a day-to-day basis. So I'm always looking at the days and kind of figuring out what happened in many years ago. And today is the, I think it's the 154th anniversary of the Lincoln assassination. And as a result, I'm going to have the Illinois State Historian, who is going to talk a little bit about some of the unknown facts of the Lincoln assassination. A woman was convicted of conspiracy along with John Wilkes Booth, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. Little known facts and some interesting coincidences as well. But as I was looking at April 14th, there's some very interesting things that happened. In fact, JCPenney opened its first store in 1902. It was called the Golden Rule Store, and it was opened in Kemmerer, Wyoming. And that obviously became a big catalog and retail store all over the country. The first sitting president to throw a pitch in a baseball game happened in the year 1902, and that was William Taft, and he, 1910, and he was our most corpulent president. We don't say fat anymore. We don't use those words.
Pleasingly plump.
He was a big man.
Yeah.
He was robust. Right?
Well, I like that.
I guess there's some other words there. Rotund. I don't know.
And he filled the space around him.
He did. And he threw out the pitch, but was really interesting. He wasn't even scheduled to attend the baseball game that day, and he only did it because he wanted to cheer himself up. Apparently, he'd met with the 42nd Annual Suffragist Convention earlier in the day, and he was not in favor of women voting. And during the meeting, he famously exclaimed that if women were allowed to vote, quote, power might be exercised by the least desirable person. That's not very nice, is it?
No, not at all.
No.
Goodness gracious.
So he faced some hostilities that day, so he headed to Washington, D.C. National Park for a pick-me-up, and he decided to throw out the first pitch, and so that happened in 1910. What else happened? Oh, the first Cubs game was broadcast on radio. On what station?
Let me see. Does it start with a W?
And it ends with an N.
I think there's a G in the middle.
G.
G.
1925, the first Cubs game was broadcast on WGN radio. Isn't that cool?
That is so neat. And all of this happened before I was born.
Yes.
Which is kind of weird.
And there's the Titanic. I'm not sure. That was about even with your...
I was nowhere near the boat. Honest to goodness.
You just tipped it right over, Roger.
I looked at it. That's all I did. I was a long ways away.
1912, the Titanic, April 14th. And 1903, the first vaccine against typhoid occurred, was invented or approved to be used on April 14th. So all kinds of things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, all kinds of things happen.
Very cool.
You know, I'm going to talk a little bit about a topic that is of interest to me, and I want to have this bleed over into the next segment. But this... April is a bad month for mass murder and terrorism. Research and experts do not like to turn that calendar page because so many bad things happen in April. And there's a little bit of an idea that there's a copycat thing going on. Waco happened in 1993 in April. Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Columbine happened in 1999. Virginia Tech massacre 07. Boston Marathon 2013. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Lincoln was assassinated. There was another school shooting in Franklin, mass stabbings in 2014. So all these things happen in April. And I know in the courthouse where I ply my trade, they sometimes lock down and go through extra security measures on certain days in April because people just tend to do these things in clusters. As I was thinking about that, I've been reading this week, there were several articles, including one in The Atlantic, that was talked about how children are being trained in school shooting protocol. And in 32 states, it's mandatory that students get training in how to handle terrorism or a school shooting. 4.1 million students have been through training in the last year, including over 200,000 kindergartners. Now, I don't know if these are related, but the statistics are that 32% of all children between the ages of 13 and 18 have anxiety disorders, diagnosed anxiety disorders, and the median onset for those disorders is age 6. So my question is this, and this is what the articles have been questioning. Are we scaring our kids in school? Are we subjecting them to these drills that really terrorize them and make them anxious and make them depressed? I just don't remember, you know, the tornado drills that I recall back in the 1960s to be so terrifying. In fact, I guess we thought they were kind of fun. But the idea of some of these drills will actually go unannounced. So the students think that there's an actual shooting. They shoot off guns with blanks in them, of course, and they actually throw fake blood sometimes on the floors in some of these schools. And so these kids don't know if it's real. They don't know if it's drill. And they're taught to sing songs to this one I saw online where you sing it to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, lock the door, shut the lights, and say no more. So these kids are singing songs about how to escape from a school shooter. I would like to hear from our listening audience. Are there any educators out there who have taken part in these kinds of drills? And what kind of feedback do you get from parents? And what kind of feedback do you get from children? Are there any psychologists out there who have listened to children complain about this or be terrorized by it? And if you have any children at home who would like to call me and, you know, and get on the phone and tell me what the drills are like and if they like them or if they're afraid of them, or how they react to those kinds of things. Again, we're living in a day and age where these things are much more common than we would like, but frankly, they're not as common as, say, getting in a car accident, being abused by somebody, or having some other tragedy happen. Is it worth it? Should we be having these children go through these drills? Is it really making anyone safer? And that's the hard part. We don't know, because hopefully the schools aren't going to have these incidents and we're not going to be able to measure who survives and who doesn't and based upon the drill training. So give us a call. Anyone who's interested in weighing in on this topic, 312-981-7200, or text me, 981-7200. Let's take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk about school shootings and how they affect children. Bye-bye. Here's the question. When students are trained in school shooting drills, which a lot of schools, it's mandatory that they receive that training, is that terrorizing them? Is that causing them harm that is irreparable? And is it causing them anxiety and depression? Is this something we should be doing? Is it really helping students does it make them feel prepared and more powerful in the situation, or does it do the opposite? 981-7200. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen. I just went through this training last Wednesday. It was put on by a private company that consists of policemen, ex-policemen, retired policemen, and so forth. And they were talking about how they have trained so many different companies and mainly schools and teachers and students, naturally, to react properly in the event of an active shooter. And the one thing that they were talking about was how important it is to be aware of your surroundings, whether it be at a restaurant, at your workplace, wherever, how to identify various exits and what to expect and kind of how to react properly.
And you know what? If it's for adults, I get it, because I like the idea. It's sort of like even in certain training for self-defense, you are always looking to move across the street if someone's, you know, you're always aware of your surroundings. And I understand that for adults, but I would imagine the training for children is very different. And do our children able to grasp and apply what they know? I'm sure your training was for adults, right, Eric?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
I think that at a certain age that the kids can comprehend the content of the training. They had mentioned that a lot of their school training is at, you know, begins at the middle school level up until the high school and college level. And they were talking about how Columbine was kind of the instigating incident for all these subsequent school shootings.
Yeah.
So they were talking about the kind of the mindset that the FBI is able to kind of comprise, the mindset of an active shooter, so they can do kind of a profile, so to speak.
Got it.
Eric,
thank you. I want to get to some people. I've got some teachers here who apparently are involved in some of the training, but thank you for the call, and I think that's a good point that we're getting this in not only in schools, we're getting this in corporate America and in buildings, et cetera. Let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan. Welcome to WGN.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
So I'm a teacher, and our building does ALICE training, and we've done a couple active shooter drills as staff, and they have the police officer comes in and actually shoots off blanks and makes it very real world. And I actually have to say I really do appreciate these drills because it kind of kicks that training in if it, you know, the worst case scenario ever happens. And the ALICE training teaches you, you know, not just to lock down, but, you know, evacuate if at all possible.
Dan, how old are the kids that you teach in your classroom?
13, 14.
Okay. And have you watched them? I mean, how do they interact on this? I mean, I imagine on the surface, they're having kind of making fun of it and doing what that kids that age does. But do you see any of them that are concerned or you feel like they're being terrorized about this?
You know, I don't think so. Like I said, you know, these kids these age just sometimes think it's a joke. You know, locking down with them, it's trying to keep them silent is the biggest concern. But I think overall, just given the climate that we've been in, I think it's important for them to see it's, you know, we're not just going to stay put. We're going to leave and be safe if, like I said, the worst case happens.
Dan, do you know if that training is mandatory in the state of Illinois?
You know, I don't know. Like I said, every district does something different. Like I said, we do ALICE training.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit what that is in case they don't know?
Sure. So ALICE training, it's not necessarily a set of steps, but it first is ALICE stands for alert, then lockdown, inform, counter, and evacuate. So instead of the traditional lockdown where you hide in a corner out of sight, it's about making sure you know what's going on, having that information presented to you, and then get out of the building if you can. And if you need to counter, so don't just sit by while if the attacker comes in, you counter them, throw anything you can, then books, desks, anything that you can get your hands on to, you know, keep yourself safe and survive the incident.
Got it. Okay. Well, Dan, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Have a good
thank
evening.
You. You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. 981-7200, 981-7200. Do you have children, and have you have children who have gone through this training for school shooting safety? Or are there any children there who you have who are articulate enough to want to come on my radio show and tell me how they're reacting to it? Is it something that they think is positive? Does it empower you as a child? Or does it make you afraid? Let's go to Maggie. Hi, Maggie.
Ooh. Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I have some stories. We're driving and my daughter is telling me so many stories. I mean, I believe it affects them, but they should know. I mean, my kids would come home after school and say how certain kids actually believe that it's true, and they start crying and they do kind of freak out in a way. You know, your teacher, for example, was saying that the kids, well, the 13, 14-year-olds as well. I mean, my daughter said one of her friends was crying, an eighth grader. And the teachers don't necessarily know also if it, they don't alarm them, saying if it's true, if it's the real alarm, or if it's just a test.
So that's one of the things that I was interested in. They don't always say, this is a fire drill. This is all fake.
They don't.
So
right, those.
I mean,
the fire drills.
Yeah, I just find that, I mean, that seems to me to be needless harm to the children, unless I'm missing something.
They know, right. And I mean, I know they would never know if it's the real, if it's happening for real, because we don't know. But, you know, the kindergarten or the first grade, they get scared. I had my youngest one in second grade. She panicked. She came home and said, "Mommy, I didn't know if it was real." And then the couple days after, the kids are in that mode in class, kind of paranoid, scared, thinking, will this happen? Will it happen? Will it happen?
Maggie, do you think that your daughter will do, like, let's just say, God forbid, there was some school shooting or something in the classroom that was required mm-hmm. her to do, you know, do some of these things that she's being drilled on. Do you think that that she and some of the classmates would be able to follow those directions and that it would kick in and they would be able to successfully implement what they've learned?
I think for her, it would, because she's on the level where I explain to her and I talk to her. I think parents have to do a lot with that, too. She would be ready.
Interesting.
But some kids don't mature differently and see things than panic. When panic mode kicks in, it's different. But it is important to have. Another quick story. She had a substitute teacher during the drill. She said the substitute teacher panicked, didn't know where the key was to the classroom to lock the door. And then the whole class started panicking. So I don't know if these drills, if the substitutes have to participate and know what to do. But, for example, her substitute did not know what to do.
Maggie,
and that was in eighth grade.
Would your daughter be willing to come on and talk about it for a minute?
Sure, yeah, she's right next to me. Her name is Anastasia.
Anastasia, beautiful name. Hi, Anastasia.
Thank you. Yeah, so basically while the drill was going on, he didn't know where the key was, and the whole class was like freaking out because they didn't know if it was real or not.
Oh, and how did that make you feel?
I mean, I was panicked myself because I actually didn't know if it was real. So I was here like, I don't know what was going to happen.
Anastasia, do you feel a little bit safer because you've had this training about how to react in case there was some sort of violence in your school?
Yes.
So you feel like you're a little more powerful because of that?
Yes.
Does it make you afraid? Does it make you think about it and worry about it?
I mean, not really, but if it does happen, yes. But the training, I feel like it helps me. Like, I feel prepared when it happens.
Well, good.
If it does.
Good. All right, Anastasia, will you stay in school, do well in school? You sounds like you got a great mom, and you'll go to college, and then you can be a lawyer just like me.
Yes.
All right. Take care. Thanks for the call. Appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
We'll be listening.
Thank you. Just one more. I wonder how children in Israel react. They are under stress all the time with bombs going off and gunfire. People who want to destroy, I get that. Also, hi, Karen. This is a texter from 630. I'm in second grade classroom. Our elementary school does a lockdown every year, far less dramatic than Dan was talking about. However, we play it down as a drill so they're not stressed out. It's not enough to prepare them for the madness that will ensue in a real emergency. Our kids are so used to it, they move on without a second thought. But I don't know if it will ever prepare anyone enough for a real situation. Another texter from 912 says, I'm an educator in Florida. Last year after the Stoneman Douglas, I went in my class, third grade, and almost started crying. I couldn't imagine anyone wanting to hurt these kids. This year I'm in fifth grade. The kids make off-color jokes about the drills, but they still take them very seriously. So thank you very much for those texts. Interesting topic. And, you know, maybe at some other point we're going to get an expert on to really talk about the psyche of kids and how, if this is a damaging thing or if it's a positive thing. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Anybody here seen my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. You know, I just looked around.
Today is the 154th anniversary of the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. He was the first American president to be assassinated. I've asked the Illinois State historian, Dr. Samuel Wheeler, to join us. Dr. Wheeler directs the collection and research at the fabulous Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum in our wonderful state capital of Springfield. Welcome to the show, Dr. Wheeler. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on, Karen, on this really a sad day in American history as we look back on the events of 154 years ago tonight.
And, you know, I have to say, and we're going to talk a little bit about the museum. Everybody needs to go there. But I was most impressed, and I've probably been there 25 times. I was most impressed by the assassination, the treatment of the assassination of Lincoln. It was so real. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how the Library Museum actually portrays the assassination?
Yeah, so one of the wonderful things that they did when they created the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, they got together groups of really fabulous scholars, teachers, collectors, people that are really interested in museums, and they talked these issues out. How do we depict events like the assassination? And, you know, when you walk into the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum and journey to in that part where you all know what's coming, the end of Abraham Lincoln's life, you come into a little scene that is a replica of the state box that night on April 14th, 1865, where Abraham and Mary are sitting in the box, kind of cozy with one another, and their guests are there with them, and museum visitors can see the famous actor, John Wilkes Booth, prowling in the hall outside of the state box, getting ready to enter the state box and do one of the most dastardly deeds in American history.
One of the fun facts, and I don't mean fun because this is not a fun issue, but there's some mm-hmm. interesting facts that a lot of people don't know. And can you talk a little bit about who attended the theater with Lincoln and his wife and why they ended up being the couple that were chosen to go?
Oh, sure. So, you know, a lot of folks don't realize that night, you know, Lincoln was not the only target. It was sort of the rumor around town that Ulysses S. Grant would be with Lincoln in the presidential box. Booth and his conspirators had launched a plan that they were going to assassinate not just Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, but there were also conspirators that were going to go after the vice president, Andrew Johnson, as well as the secretary of state, William Seward. But in attendance that night at the theater with the Lincolns, Grant had told Lincoln earlier in the day that he would have to decline that invitation. And throughout the day, the Lincolns had asked some 15 different people to join them in the presidential box that night. And one by one, individuals had excuses to decline the invitation.
Isn't that interesting that you said no?
Yeah.
You say no to the president. Hey, you want to hang out with me in the theater? And people are saying no to him. Kind of probably good decisions looking back.
Yeah, some of them have, you know, really nice, really, you know, legitimate excuses. Others, we think that, you know, maybe the wives didn't get along with Mary Lincoln, for instance. That's why some folks would have turned down those invitations. But eventually, they get a young couple named Henry Rathbone, who's a military officer in the Union, and his fiancée, Clara Harris, who is the daughter of a New York senator, Ira Harris. And this young couple, Abraham and Mary, pick them up in their carriage that night on the way to Ford's Theater. And I could imagine that would be a highlight in their life. They would expect, sort of looking back, to attend the theater 5 days after the virtual end of the Civil War with Abraham Lincoln, who was reportedly in very good spirits that night.
And is it true that when Booth came in, he actually slashed Rathbone as well? He slashed him with the knife.
Yeah, so Henry Rathbone is sitting, you know, closest to the door, and this is one of the big regrets of Rathbone's life, that he's not able to stop this assassin. Booth comes into the box, shoots Lincoln at point-blank range. Booth chooses the funniest line in the play to pull the trigger when the laughter of all the folks in attendance could mask the sound of his gunshot. And Rathbone gets up from his seat, begins to struggle with the assassin, and Booth, yes, he slashes Henry Rathbone, and it's a very grisly scene. Booth pries his way loose of Rathbone, and he leaps from the state box down onto the stage, a leap of maybe 10 feet, and the audience is surprised. They don't know what to make of this. Maybe they didn't hear the gunshot, but you see a man jump from the state box onto the stage, and folks recognize him as a well-known actor. This is, you know, the young, handsome, charismatic John Wilkes Booth, and Booth waves a bloody knife at the crowd, and he yells something that folks don't understand exactly what he said, but today we think he said, "Sic semper tyrannis." It's the Virginia State motto, thus ever to tyrant.
Dr. Weaver, and, now, he breaks his leg at this point, correct?
Yeah, when he jumps down onto the stage, his foot gets wrapped up in the flag, and we think that he broke his leg upon impact.
And interesting, is it true that that's where we get that phrase, break a leg?
I've heard that before, but I think that's probably a myth.
Okay, because it makes sense. Break a leg, you're going on the stage, right? But I guess we'll never know that. But just going back just quickly, I just want to just wrap this up on Rathbone and the Harris. They had a tortured life afterwards, correct? Am I right about that?
Yeah, nothing good happens to anybody in the presidential box that night, but Henry Rathbone and Claire Harris, they go on to get married, and Rathbone struggles with mental instability, and, you know, near Christmas in 1883, he murders his wife. It's a horrible scene that takes place in Germany. He murders his wife, and he spends the rest of his life in an insane asylum in Germany.
And Mary didn't do too well either at the end there.
No, Mary Todd Lincoln has a terrible widowhood. You know, in some ways, you know, that day she and her husband are riding a carriage at the end of his work day, and they're dreaming about what life after the presidency might look like. And he talks about he wants to travel after the presidency. He says he wants to go to Europe. He wants to see the Holy Land. He even wants to go to California and see the gold fields. It's interesting that in Mary Lincoln's widowhood, she makes good on some of her husband's wishes. She does travel extensively. She takes their young son, Tad, to Europe to be educated in Germany, and she travels all throughout Europe. But in so many ways, it's not a good widowhood.
And quickly, before we take a break, there's a couple things I want to run through very, very quickly. Was it true that John Wilkes Booth's brother had some interaction with the Lincolns prior to the assassination?
That's right. Edwin Booth was a well-known actor as well. And during the Civil War, when Robert was traveling between Harvard and the White House, there's a scene that takes place in Jersey City at a train station. And Robert loses his balance. He falls onto the train tracks. He needs somebody to help him back up onto the platform because there's an approaching train. And Edwin Booth is the man that offers Robert his hand. Robert recognizes him immediately. He writes about this years later, but isn't it ironic that the assassin's brother saves the president's
son.
Oldest boy?
So is that Robert, just to clarify, Robert is the son of Abraham Lincoln. So the brother of the assassin saves the president's son in a just completely,
that's right,
completely unrelated incident. And maybe just one more very, very quickly. Is it true that Lincoln created the Secret Service the very day he was assassinated?
Yeah, so the Secret Service, when it was originally created, their job was not to protect the president. Their job was to hunt down counterfeiters. It's not until the assassination of William McKinley in the 20th century does the Secret Service really become tied into protecting the president of the United States.
Interesting. We're talking to Dr. Samuel Wheeler, who is the Illinois State Historian, and we're talking about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. If you have any questions for us, call us at 981-7200 or text us 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN.
When Lincoln's marching home again, hurrah, hurrah, we'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah, for the men will cheer, the boys will
Welcome in. We are talking about the 154th anniversary of President Abraham Lincoln's assassination, and we're very fortunate to have Dr. Samuel Wheeler, who is the Illinois State Historian. What a great job. And he deals with the research and the collections at the wonderful Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Welcome back in, Dr. Wheeler.
Oh, good to be with you, Karen.
Okay. So the Ford Theater it just seems like a lot of people involved in this were cursed in some way. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to the theater after the assassination?
Sure. After the assassination, United States Congress comes in and they want to ensure that site is not going to be used anymore for, you know, public entertainment. They don't want it to become, you know, sort of a ghoulish shrine. And so it becomes a government building. They buy it from John Ford. They use it for 20 some years as a government installation. And then in 1893, half of the building collapses and kills 22 government employees. A
wow.
horrible tragedy that took place. Something like, you know, more than 60 other people are injured during that collapse.
Wow.
You know, and if you go back even further before the assassination, Ford bought that site from a Baptist church. He converted that church into a theater, and the original theater burned down in 1862. So the building that Lincoln was assassinated in was actually the second Ford Theater at that location.
Wow. We have a texter who says, how did we get the gun? I'm not sure what he means. Does the museum have the gun that was used?
That'll be it's property of the federal government. And so that's on display. You can go to Ford's Theater today. They have a beautiful, site, there in Washington, D.C. and at Ford's Theater. They use it as a working theater, but they also have a museum, to Lincoln and the assassination, and Booth's gun is on display.
Interesting. So one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is Mary Surratt. And I want to ask you a little bit about Mary Surratt. And let's talk a little bit about what her alleged involvement was, what happened to her. And then I'd like your opinion on, was she really involved with the assassination of our president?
Sure. So Mary Surratt, you know, owns the boarding house where Booth and the co-conspirators met several times in Washington. She also owns a tavern in Maryland that plays a role in the assassination as well. The co-conspirators hid rifles in this tavern in Maryland run by a man named John Lloyd. And the case against Mary Surratt says that, you know, she doesn't just own the boarding house. She doesn't just own the tavern. She doesn't just know these co-conspirators, but actually she knows their plans, and she's aiding and abetting them. So, for instance, a few days before the assassination, she tells Lloyd that there'll be some guys that will come by in a few days, and they'll need those rifles. On the day of the assassination, she tells Lloyd that the people will be by tonight, and she also stashes a pair of Booth's binoculars that he'll need that night. And of course, on the night of the assassination, Booth and Davy Harold will go to that tavern. And I think one of the most interesting pieces against her, a couple days after the assassination, when investigators are talking to Mary Surratt at her boarding house in Washington, they end up arresting her. And who shows up to her boarding house but Louis Payne, the co-conspirator that had brutally attacked William Seward. He comes to the boarding house. He gives a very flimsy story to the investigators. He says he's going to dig a gutter outside the boarding house, and the investigators ask Mary Surratt, do you know this man? And she denies knowing him. If she's innocent, perhaps, what would it have hurt saying that she knew who Payne was if she didn't know what he had been up to?
So she's charged, and this happened pretty quickly after the assassination, the whole trial, did it not?
Absolutely. These co-conspirators, the Lincoln conspirators, they are tracked down relatively quickly. They are arrested. They are tried. And on July 7th, 1865, that's less than 3 months after the crime, a number of them are hanged. And Mary Surratt becomes the first woman hanged by the federal government.
Now, I did a retrial of Mary Surratt about 8 years ago at the Harold Washington Library. I represented her, and we had an actress who played her, and then the audience got to vote as jurors, and I of course, got an acquittal for Mary, but it was a little late, maybe 150 years too late. But what is your what is your opinion, just knowing the evidence that you have seen, and you probably, you know, read lots of different source materials that we don't have time to really discuss, but like, what's your gut feeling? Do you think she really was involved?
Well, I applaud you for getting an acquittal. You were probably a better attorney than she ever had access to. She was tried by a military tribunal, which was very suspect. But, you know, my gut says that Mary knew what was going on and she's guilty. Should the punishment for her crime have been execution? I don't know about that. But no, from what I've read, I would say that that she knew what was going on.
And is it true that Lincoln had premonitions about his death? And could you briefly tell us what those were? We just have just a few minutes.
Sure.
Yeah, just a few minutes.
Okay. Yeah, there's been some dreams that Lincoln had that have been attributed to him. Some of those are suspect, but I think the best one that we can say actually occurred is a story he told on this day 154 years ago during a cabinet meeting. He convened a meeting of his cabinet. They talked about the war. General Grant said that he was very anxious to hear some news from William Sherman. And Lincoln told the cabinet, we know this because cabinet members recorded this in their diary afterwards, he says, "I think you're going to get good news from Sherman because I had a dream last night. It's a recurring dream that I had before every big event of the Civil War. And in this dream, I'm on some sort of a ship. I'm floating down the river at a, and as I'm floating, I'm picking up speed going towards a destination off in the distance." And that's about the point that he wakes up in the dream. But he says it's prophetic. It precedes big events in the Civil War. He says, "Sherman's going to tell you some really good news because something big is about to happen." And of course, that night, he's assassinated.
Interesting. Quick yes or no question from a texter 312. Is the phrase "your name is Mudd," is that due to doctor, I believe his name was Samuel Mudd, who was the doctor who actually helped fix up Booth's leg after the assassination? Is that true or false?
I suspect there is something to that. The one of the finest books on the whole Samuel Mudd thing is called "His Name Is Still Mudd."
So that's probably the case. And just, I'm telling you, just one little quick one. I looked at your dissertation, you're a PhD, and you did your dissertation on Abraham Lincoln's poetry. And I guess I've never heard that he wrote poetry. Is it good, nice poetry?
Oh, gosh, it's one of my favorite topics, of course. Is it good poetry? Well, I don't know about that. I don't know how great of a poet he was, but what I will say is it's revealing poetry. I think he talks about some issues that he never would talk about in standard letters or in conversation, but it's the medium of poetry that he's able to get some distance from sort of the topic, and he's able to explore some topics that I think we're really interested in. So, yeah, it's a dissertation being revised into a book, and I'm really, really excited about talking about that.
Great. Well, the last thing I want to wrap up with is I want to talk about the museum. I want you to be able to tell our listeners, and listen, I'm not the biggest history buff. I like history. I'm not a big, like, spend two days at a museum. I have a short attention span sometimes, but I adore this Presidential Library Museum. It is just an interactive, very interesting, very fast-paced. They've always got different exhibits that will draw you there. It's just a great place to be. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who can enjoy it, what age groups, and what you can expect when you go there?
Sure. Thank you so much for the kind words about our museum. I love it as well. you know, I think anybody can come to our museum and get something out of it, from children all the way to, you know, adult learners for sure. So much care, so much time was put into the design of the permanent exhibit there. And as you say, we've got temporary exhibits as well that come up all the time. But, you know, you can spend as little as an hour there, or you can spend the day there. It's not uncommon. You know, there's all sorts of museum visitors, but it's a very immersive experience. A challenge of folks to come. I think it's unlike any other museum you've ever been in. You're standing inside the cabinet room, inside the little cabin where he grew up. At a point in time, I think the magic of the museum, you forget you're walking through a museum. You're transported back in time.
Exactly.
And creators did that through great exhibits and music and an immersive experience.
It's a fabulous place. I highly, highly recommend it. Dr. Samuel Wheeler, thank you so much for joining us. And when you finish your book on poetry, you can come back and we can read some Abraham Lincoln poetry. How's that?
Well, that sounds like a deal to me. Okay. Thanks for having me on, Karen.
Thank you so much for coming on. When we come back, we're going to be taking your legal questions. So this is the time for the next hour. We're going to call it the Game of Phones. The Game of Phones tonight. 981-7200 if you have questions about divorce, if you have questions about traffic tickets, you have questions about wills and estates. I'll try my best to give you some advice. And you'll be talking to Ben on the phone, 981-7200.
K to the A, R to the E, N.
Karen,
she's the boss. K to the A, R to the E, N.
And we go a little something like this. Hit it!
Criminal investigation, legal interpretation, swindle of the elderly, mistaken identity, second chances, unwanted advances, co-worker flirtation, HR violation, wrongful termination, legal consultation.
Karen,
she's the boss.
Whatever your legal jam, call Karen Conti as fast as you can.
Karen,
she's the boss.
Now's your time to get your calls in. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. A text to that same number. We've got Sheila on the line. Hi, Sheila. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's your legal question?
Well, I have my next door neighbor, and she has cameras on four corners of the house and four corners of her garage. And she knows when I come and go and who visits me. I was wondering if there any kind of Illinois statute that, you know, is there some type of rule against that?
Sheila, this is a common problem, and it's getting more and more common. And I think we even dealt with this a little bit last show. Basically, you can put cameras on the outside of your house and on the outside of your garage. Basically, the limit is if it's impacting your privacy inside the home, so that if it's directing the camera to outside, to where the walkways are, your yard, places where you're outside and where you have no expectation of privacy, that would be okay. But for instance, if there was a camera that was directed into a window, for instance, that could see into your living room or your bedroom, that would be inappropriate, and that would be something that would be actionable. But, you know, it just, I know what you're saying. You just don't like the fact that she knows exactly what you're doing all the time, and there's a lot of nosy neighbors. I don't know what they do with their lives, but they sit and they watch their neighbors, and they can talk about them, and they can talk about their coming and their going, and it's very disturbing. And I don't think there's anything really you can do. I mean, you know, even talking to neighbors like this sometimes will agitate them enough to so they will increase their surveillance rather than stop it, because they feel like they're entitled to do what they do. You know, I don't know do you think it's worth talking to the neighbor and saying, you know, it just makes me feel a little uncomfortable that you have these cameras all over and you know where I come and go, and is there some way you can tone it down or, you know, take a few of them out? Would she respond to that?
No.
No.
She's not a reasonable person, no.
No, no. I know the type. And really, unfortunately, that's I don't have any good news for you. But thanks for the call, Sheila.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, these neighborhood disputes are just awful. I mean, whether it's...
Certainly, that's... I don't have any good news for you.
whether that's over a border, whether that's over planting trees that, you know, that the other party doesn't like. It's fences. I think that one of the Cubs players was just sued. He erected a fence in the suburbs of Chicago, and he was sued because someone said that was against code. So, you know, you have these kinds of issues, and it causes a lot of tension. And, you know, it's a terrible thing to go home to the place where you're supposed to relax and you're supposed to be able to, you know, be safe and to be comfortable and happy, and you can't because you've got neighbors who are making your life miserable. It's very, very difficult, and you have to be very careful when dealing with them so you don't make the problem worse instead of better. 981-7200, 981-7200. The phone lines are wide open, and Ben is going to be listening to your questions. I have a couple that I received through email this week that I'd like to share with you. One was from a really wonderful man named Morton, who had a person in his life who was 81 years old. She got a letter from the Chicago police stating that her car and her license plates were eluding police in a chase and that she has to pay $2,000 or face charges. She said her car was locked in the garage. The keys were on top of her refrigerator. No one could get her car. No one, it was impossible for someone to get the keys. And she went down to the local police, and they were rude and insisted her car was involved in this eluding activity. The first thing I said to Morton, the caretaker here, who was taking care of this woman, which was a nice thing to do, was that you have to be careful of scams. Now, she went down there, and maybe there was some verification that this was a real situation. But I've seen an awful lot of scams where you receive a letter and you say, it says, oh, you know, you did this, or it's the IRS, it's the police, pay money or else you're going to be prosecuted for a crime, or we're going to come and take away your home. And people send money, and they pay. They write a check, and it goes somewhere, and you never know where it was because it's a whole scam. So if you receive something like this, I'm not saying ignore it because you don't want to ignore it, but you need to make sure that even the phone number that you call is correct, because I know that sometimes they actually set up phones that will answer like the IRS or like the police department. So it turns out that after a couple of phone calls back and forth and emails back and forth with Morton, he went back down to the police department, found somebody who was apologetic for the rudeness that this woman got. She's 81 years old. And it turns out that it probably was a police error, and they probably mistakenly took down her license plate, put a different number in and transposed it. And obviously she wasn't involved in it. And it was going to be hopefully taken care of. If she had to go to court, then she was going to have to go to court and testify that it was impossible that the car could have been out. But that's just kind of an interesting issue. And, you know, police do make mistakes. So also, I got a email from a Carrie, who was interested in the Jussie Smollett case. And I know, you know, I've been talking about this on and off for several weeks now. But the question was, he was just sued this week, and Carrie wanted to know, how is it that they can ask for treble damages, three times the amount of the actual damages that the city incurred as a result of the alleged false allegations and the false information that he gave to the police? And there's actually a statute. I looked it up. It's not a very commonly used statute, but it's a statute that says if you lie to the police department, if you give a false statement, the police and the city can come after you and sue you, not only for the actual cost of what man hours it took, what extra time it took for the police officers to do this investigation, but also treble damages, three times the amount. Obviously, the reason for this law is they want to prevent people from making false claims to a police officer. But that's the nature of why they are able to ask for that. And just so you know, he is being sued. My prediction was that someone was going to pay off that amount for him, some anonymous donor, some GoFundMe page. But the issue now is going to be this whole issue of whether he lied to the police, whether he made the false police report, whether he was actually attacked or whether it was all false. That's all now going to be litigated unless it's settled. And that means it's a lawsuit, which means that subpoenas can be sent. My guess is that the prosecution's case and the investigation file from the police and all of the statements that were given by various witnesses and potential witnesses, all the videotapes that might be there from cameras outside, all of the evidence of text messages between and among Jussie Smollett and the two Nigerian brothers who are said to be the people who perpetrated this with him. All of those things are going to probably be unsealed, would be my guess. And we, the public, are going to know what all this evidence is, because Jussie Smollett has to prove that he didn't lie to the police. And because the city is arguing, yes, you lied to the police, and as a result, that caused damage. So their evidence has to be that he lied, and Jussie's going to have to defend that. So instead of making this go away, instead of this going away and him living his life and these facts not coming to light, it's going to have the exact opposite effect. We're going to know more than we knew in the criminal case, and it's probably going to be bad for everyone unless it's paid off and settled. Give us a call here. I'm going to be answering questions for the next 45 minutes. We're doing the game of phones tonight. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200.
You can put away your tissues, because here's the answer to your legal issues. 30 years experience in this town. Karen Conti wears the legal crown, and it's about to go down.
Give me a call here. The phone lines are open. This is your time to get some legal advice from me. Maybe I'll answer your question. Maybe I'll steer you in the right direction. 981-7200, or text to that same number. Listen, if you have a question, too, about anything that you've seen in the news, sometimes people have questions about things they read, and I can maybe explain a little bit better and a little bit in more detail, and I'm happy to do that. In the meantime, I'm going to go to some my legal mailbag here. There is Roger from Elmhurst says, what makes a contract binding? I have been doing repair work in my home, and I don't know if an oral agreement for a certain price is binding. Well, it's always better when you're having repair work done to get it in writing. And really, there's no reason not to. Most good and reputable repair people will have a written contract. And it doesn't always say contract on the document. It might say invoice, or it might say statement, or, you know, it might say something else. But the operative things would be is, what is he going to do, or what is she going to do? In detail, I'm going to repair the windows. I'm going to replace them with what kind of windows? Pella windows, different kinds of windows. And I'm going to do it in this amount of time, and I'm going to do it for this amount of price. And here is my labor, and here are my parts, and here are the terms of payment. And generally speaking, you shouldn't pay it all up front. Certainly, if there are materials, especially expensive materials, you don't want to give the money to the repair person for them to buy it. You will tell the repair person that you will buy it directly, or you'll put the credit card at Home Depot or whatever it is to buy them, because what you don't want is a repair person to take your money and walk with it. And that happens way too often. I see it happen all the time. I can't tell you, I don't think a week goes by without somebody saying they were ripped off by someone who came in and underbid everyone and took the money and ran, and they never saw him again. And there's really nothing you can do to find these people or to sue them. And even if you sue them, it's almost impossible to collect from them, because they don't care. And they don't care if they have a judgment against them. But if a repairman says, I'm going to fix your window for $100, that is technically an oral agreement. And if you agree and you pay them $100, that he should fix your window, and that's legally binding. But it's always better to get it in writing, and there's no reason not to. And you also want to see if this person has insurance. Is this person bonded? Is this person licensed to do business in your municipality? You might want to quickly Google him. I mean, is he an LLC? Is he a corporation? Is he a business entity? And does he guarantee his work? Look at the references. I mean, even for something small, I mean, I wouldn't want to lose $500. It's not enough to sue over, but certainly you want to make sure this person is going to do the job and is reputable. Bob sent me an email from LaGrange. He wanted to know, he has been following this college admission scandal, as we all have been, As you may have seen this week, some of the people are pleading guilty, including Felicity Huffman apparently is going to be pleading guilty, and she issued an apology, and her case will probably be over quickly. Some of them are not pleading guilty, and the cases will go on. But Bob wanted to know, can the students be ousted from the colleges, the ones who were admitted there based upon fraud? And the answer is yes. I don't think there's any reason why the colleges would not do that or not be able to do that from a legal standpoint, because the admission process was a fraud in the cases of these people whose parents paid for them to get in one way, shape, or form, take a test or fake their athletic participation, whatever it is. And clearly, they could say that you were admitted under false pretenses and we're going to yank your admission. Are they going to do that? I don't know. Maybe they feel badly for the kids. I doubt it. I think that they're going to be able to make a very good argument that that's in the best interest of everyone. And frankly, the other students would probably, there'd probably be a little bit of bullying if I know how that works in college. So, yes, the students, in my view, can be ousted, and particularly the students maybe who haven't even started yet, that the admission is in the future, and those could be yanked, definitely yanked. I had a texter who wants to know what happens when you are denied unemployment. How can an employer deny your unemployment benefits, and what can you do if that happens? Generally speaking, unemployment benefits are available if you've been working for a company for a certain amount of time and you've earned a certain amount of money, and all that is online and available. But generally speaking, you are entitled to unemployment if you are fired, except if you were fired for misconduct. And generally speaking, misconduct is something that involves you violating a known rule. So let's just say that you have a rule that you have to be there at 8:30 in the morning, and you're not there until 8:45, and then you get a write-up, and then the next day you're there at 9, and you're half an hour late, and you get a write-up, and they fire you. Well, they can fire you for that, because that was misconduct, and that was a known rule, and they were warned you, and you didn't comply. And so the employer then can deny you unemployment benefits based upon that. So that's always a question. What is misconduct? Is it just they don't like the way you're doing something, or is it a known violation of a known rule? The other way is if you are, you know, insubordinate, or you do something dangerous or unsafe. I had a case where the woman just got angry and threw something at her boss. Clearly, she was fired. Clearly, the employer was justified in denying her unemployment because she was insubordinate. She threw something. It was an assault. Actually, it was a crime. So there was good reason. And if you quit your job, you can't get unemployment. So let's just say you're having a hard time at work, you don't like your boss, and you get in a huff and you quit. Nope, no unemployment benefits for you. One of the things that you should know is if you're denied, sometimes employers will deny the benefits even if it's not right to do it. Maybe they just feel like they want to and they don't think you're going to pursue it. And unemployment benefits are really important. If you've ever lost a job, it's important to have some buffer there, and you're going to want to make sure that your family's taken care of. And so you may want to appeal that. And so make sure that if you get denied unemployment, you have 30 days to file an appeal. It's a request for reconsideration, they call it. And you put that in writing, and you can mail it or you can fax it. And then there is a hearing officer who will call you, and you will have a little hearing about what happened surrounding your termination. And then they will decide whether or not you should be getting your benefits. So in people win those all the time. You don't need a lawyer really to do it. If you want to hire a lawyer, you may hire a lawyer. But you just put your case together and you give them your best argument that you possibly can. Give us a call here, 981-7200. I have one quick question. We have a question about, what does joint custody mean? I've heard it means decision making for your children. Then I think of custody as being who does the children live with. That's a good question. And let me just tell you that the law has changed in the last 3 years, and we don't use the term custody anymore, although you still hear lawyers use it, you still hear people use it. But we don't use it anymore just because the legislature decided that custody of children just sounds like prison, and it sounds like you keep the children and their property. And we wanted to get away from that, so the legislature changed the words. There's two things. One is parental responsibilities, which means decision making, and the other is residential, who's got the residence of the children, and parenting time. Those are the words we use. We don't even really use visitation anymore. We use parenting time. So parental responsibilities are largely the decisions that you make for your children, like extracurricular activities, what school they go to, what medical treatment they get, what religion they practice. Those are decisions that are parental responsibilities, and parties can have joint parental responsibility. That's the best way. So both parents, even if they're divorced, should be talking to each other and deciding things in the best interest of their children. So that's parental responsibilities. And then parenting time and residential, where the children reside, those are issues of the time that you spend with your kids. So, you know, there's all different kinds of ways that parents share time. Some of them do it on a 50-50 basis, with Monday and Tuesday at one house and Wednesday and Thursday at another, and then maybe every other weekend rotates. Some do 1 week on, some do 1 week off. And then there's the standard kind of typical arrangement where you have the children really residing in one home predominantly, and then maybe the other parent will have a Wednesday dinner or a Wednesday overnight into Thursday drop off at school, and then maybe every other weekend. That's kind of a standard. And listen, if the parties agree on something that they think is best for their children, that is something that a court will uphold and a court will enter. But if you make the court decide it and the judge decide it, you may not know exactly what's going to happen, because judges have different views, as we all do, about where children should live and how they should live. Judges have predispositions about what mothers bring to the table, what fathers bring to the table. And some judges think that 50-50 parenting time is the default mode. Some of them think that a child should live in one house predominantly, with visitation, or as we used to call it, or parenting time with the other parent. So you always want to try to agree with your spouse and try to come to a settlement, because when you leave it to the person in the robe, you never know quite what you're going to get. So give us a call here. We've got lots of time. Phone lines are wide open, 312-981-7200. I've got Jackie. I see that we're going to get to you, and we're going to get to some of these texts in a minute. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Did it ever occur to you that I might be a very good attorney?
Well, you damn well better be. I raised you.
Beat the rap, get the acquittal. How about a prenup if you're non-committal?
How about a prenup if you're non-committal?
How about a prenup if you're non-committal?
Spring break rhyme
equals workman's comp. Workman's comp
equals workman's comp.
How about a prenup if you're non-committal?
Spring break rhyme
equals workman's comp.
Mistress pregnancy.
Company in bankruptcy.
Company in bankruptcy.
Deadbeat dad gets the boot.
Need to file a class action suit?
In a legal contract where someone blundered, call Karen Conti. 312-981-7200.
How about a prenup if you're non-committal?
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. I'm taking your legal calls now, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. Phone lines are open. Hi, Jackie. How are you?
Hi. Well, I'll find out more on Good Friday when our continued appeal is. One misconduct thing, they claimed I had misconduct. Well, we know unemployment law says it has to be intentional, and it wasn't. It's really a goofy thing. But anyway, got to this appeal hearing that my former employer set up, and found out they had an attorney and three witnesses. I don't know who they are, never heard of their names, never worked with them. Then found out that they supposedly sent papers. I have looked through my entire house. There are no papers. Asked the judge, do I get an attorney? Found out that they were supposed to let me know that, and never found that out, so it's continued. So,
Jackie,
down to the...
Jackie, can I just ask you...
What I'm asking is, how in the heck... I don't know what paper, they never told me.
Okay, hold on one second.
They continued
hold on.
I don't know what the papers are.
Wait. Hold on. So wait, this is unemployment. Is this what we're talking about?
Right.
Okay.
Yes, so, unemployment.
So were you terminated from the job?
Right, I was.
Okay, and they said it was misconduct, and they deny?
I won.
Okay, you won.
I won the first time.
Okay, and so the employer?
Then they've appealed it. The employer appealed it.
Okay.
Their attorney claims that they sent me a bunch of paperwork. I have no paperwork from an attorney. The only paperwork I have is the stuff from the unemployment office saying that I had an appeal.
So now you have a continuance, and they're supposed to send you this paperwork. Is that what's going on?
What they were supposed to, they claimed they already sent it, and I still don't even know what the paperwork is.
Okay. Well,
can I put you on speaker so my husband can hear what's going on? Is that okay?
Sure, but
I know I can't have the radio.
I'm not going to have specific advice for you because I don't know exactly what transpired here, but if they had paperwork that they said they sent you, you should call the attorney who's now on the case and ask, and I would do this in email, I would do it in writing, not over the phone, and say you referred to certain paperwork that you said that you sent me during the hearing with the hearing officer present. I never received it, and I still have not received it. Can you please email it to me immediately? And he or she can scan that to you. I imagine it would be maybe a statement from a witness, or maybe it's some correspondence that deals with your termination, or maybe something from your personnel file. I mean, who knows? You can't really prepare for the hearing unless you know what they have against you. So it's obviously very important that you get this so you can prepare. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I've dealt with, I used to work in legal, so... that's why I was like, this is ridiculous, but I didn't know what I'm supposed to do other than ask for it. Now, would you suggest that I would ask through the unemployment office?
I would let
them know, because you know how you're supposed to send in if your paperwork to the unemployment office
I don't, I can't give you really specific advice because I don't know exactly what's going on here, but I would say send it to the lawyer, and if you want to CC the hearing officer with it, if you have his or her email address, just so they know that you're trying to get it, and they might be able to move this process along and expedite you getting the documents. Okay, that's my best for you, Jackie. All right.
Well, I appreciate it. You have a wonderful night.
Okay. Good luck to you. All
Thanks.
Right. Okay. Let's see. We have, I have a texter from 815 who says, which parent can claim the kids on their taxes when there is no wording in the divorce decree about this? This question gets asked quite a bit. Normally speaking, you want to put it in your divorce decree. And normally what happens is if you have one child, the father will get the child 1 year, the mother will get the deduction the next year, and you'll rotate until the child is emancipated. If you have more than one child, usually you split them. So you get one child and he gets the other one. If there's nothing in the divorce decree, which is too bad, then basically you're going to look at the IRS rules. The IRS rules, I'm going to paraphrase them. It's basically which party spends the most time with the child. And if the parents spend equal parenting time, then it's the parent with the highest adjusted gross income. But again, what happens a lot is the parents fight about it, and then they both claim, and then there's an audit, and then there's a problem. So it's something that really needs to be decided, and maybe that you have to go back to court on it. Hopefully you don't, and hopefully you can reason with your spouse that you should share the deduction, and you should pull out that IRS code and have an accountant say, based upon these facts, you should get the deduction every year, if that's the case. We have another text from 815. Does a partner in a long-term relationship have any claim to a portion of an estate if no provisions were made or no will for either? There are two adult children. Not sure I understand the facts exactly, but what the question is, what I'm going to interpret it as, is that this person is in a long-term relationship. You're in a committed relationship, but you're not married. And maybe the other partner dies. Is there any claim that you have to the estate? And in this case, maybe the partner had two adult children. The answer is no. When you're not married to somebody, you have no rights to inherit from that person. It's as if that person is a stranger. Even if you lived with that person, the only way that you could take from that person when they die is if there was a will or a trust that specifically gave you property or assets or benefits. So that's unfortunate, and that's frankly one of the reasons. Well, there's two lessons here. If you choose not to get married, and I understand why a lot of people don't want to get married, I'm not saying that I think that's a better way to live or one way or the other, but I do think that, you know, you need to be careful, because in a case like this, you might be left high and dry. The money might go to the children, probably will, if there's no spouse, and you might be left not having the house maybe you lived in or contributed to during the relationship. Also, you both need to have an estate plan. It doesn't matter if you're married. It doesn't matter if you're not married. You should both have an estate plan to make sure that when you die, and it could happen suddenly, we're seeing people die very suddenly at very young ages, you need to have a plan in place, an inexpensive plan. If you don't know somebody to do it, call me. I'll try to find you someone reasonably priced to do it. I've got a person who I use to refer most of my clients to. I don't do it myself, but you can always email me. And at this point, I might as well give you my email address and my phone number at the office in case you want a referral to an estate planning lawyer or any other lawyer. Again, if I don't do it or if I can't handle or give you an answer, I'll try to give you my best referral. 312-332-7800, or better yet, send me an email at wgn@askkarenconti.com, KarenConti. Let's see, do we have time for maybe one more? No, maybe not. Let's take a break. And when we come back, I'm going to take, I'm still going to take your legal calls, 312-981-7200. But the third caller is going to, if you want to play my tax quiz game. We have tax day tomorrow, as you know, and I have some fun facts about taxes, and the winner will win a valuable prize. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We're going to do my little tax quiz in a few minutes. We've got Julie on the line. Hi, Julie. But I'm going to just read a couple of more texts and some emails that I got on some legal questions to wrap this up. Michael sent me an email this week. Said, "Hi, I recently read a story where Amazon uses a third party to listen in on their devices and was shocked to learn that it was being done by actual people and not computers." He cited to me a Bloomberg.com article. And he says, "I know these devices have terms and conditions where you give them access, but I was under the impression that devices were looking for keywords and it was done by a computer algorithm. How do they get around the eavesdropping law in Illinois when there's other people who might be in my home when I have my Alexa on?" Interesting. That is very interesting. And I think the answer, you know, without doing research and without seeing if this has been litigated, is that when you have an Alexa or you have a Siri or whatever it is, that you consent, you know, through the terms and conditions to being recorded. And it's probably in there. It's probably in this fine print, and it probably will exonerate them for anything that you're talking about is under the eavesdropping law. As to other people in your house who may not have given consent because they didn't buy the device, they didn't give consent to any of this, how do they get around it for these people? And my guess is the answer would be that is if you have one of those devices, they're in plain view, and that anyone in your home could see that you have one, and anyone in the home would understand that you don't have an expectation of privacy because there's somebody listening on it. Now, that's a stretch, because how would, say, a person who doesn't have one of these devices doesn't know that the device is being listened to by real people somewhere, and you say something and it's incriminating. And we've had cases where the government has subpoenaed, actually, the Alexa device and gotten all the information and all the recordings of what went on in the home. And sometimes that evidence is very crucial in the prosecution. So, and that can also be very detrimental to the people who live there and the people who whose voice was recorded. So it's a very difficult one, in it, but a good question and something that I think we're going to be dealing with down the line. Issues of privacy are going to be just very big in the future, because I think at some point it's going to be that we don't have an expectation of privacy. I think walking down the street, we used to feel like no one was looking, but now we have cameras everywhere, and that's just the way it is. I had a caller this week named Carl who says, if I get a divorce, who will pay the mortgage on my house? And in this case, Carl had a house and both names were on the mortgage, both names were on the deed. And generally speaking, if there's a divorce that gets filed, the judge will issue a ruling for status quo, meaning if you are both contributing to the mortgage, then the judge will order that you both continue to contribute to the mortgage until you're divorced, in which time you will either sell the house and you will both get the proceeds or share in the deficit, or one party can buy out the other party if they can qualify for a mortgage. So let's just say the wife wants to stay in the home with the children and there's $100,000 in equity. That wife would have to pay the husband his 50% interest by either liquidating another account or coming up with the money in some other way. But that's my best answer. Let's go to Mr. or Mrs. Schneider. Hi, welcome to WGN. You have a question about a car accident. Hello? Is that Ms. Schneider? Yes. Hello? Welcome to WGN.
Hello?
Hi. What's your legal question?
Oh, is it Sharon?
It is. Hi.
I didn't know I was on this fish.
I didn't know you were on either. So, but you're on. Okay.
Okay. My wife, on a Superior Transit bus, was involved in an accident. The bus was involved in an accident. And this is about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And she was not given any information about anything. All they did was move the bus into a parking lot, and then they started transferring people to different buses. I went actually and picked her up.
It was now, she.
Now
excuse me.
She has a nurse come to the house on a regular basis because of her conditions, and she's been complaining about neck pain. And the nurse said that she had whiplash. Now what do we do?
Okay.
We have no information about anything.
All right. So I don't know who the nurse is. That's a home nurse that's sent by the hospital.
Yes.
The first thing you do is do not talk to the insurance company. Do not talk to the transit people. If they call you, you have no obligation to talk to them. If you don't have a personal injury lawyer, either email me or call me at the office, and I will refer you to somebody who's a competent lawyer who can help either settle this case, hopefully settle it. Sounds like it's something that should be settled, but you can't settle it until your wife finishes her treatment, meaning once you settle a case and she might have problems down the line, then there's no further funds for that. So you need to make sure that she finishes her treatment, takes it as far as she can go and feeling as best she can, and the lawyer will then either settle the case or bring the lawsuit in order to get her compensation for the accident. So let me give Ben?
Hang on. I understand, but we don't even, I mean, they gave us, we don't know the police report number.
Okay, that's okay.
Nothing.
Okay. Well, that's something that the lawyer will handle. The lawyer will deal with that. Okay? That's not something that you should worry about at this point, but you should get a lawyer. It sounds like she's got some injuries, and you're going to need somebody to at least make sure she gets her medical bills paid, some pain and suffering, and whatever other medical treatment she needs. I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to have Ben give you my phone number, 312-332-7800 for the listening audience, and my email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com. Let's go to the tax quiz. Hi, Julie. Are you ready for the tax quiz?
Yes, except this is Barry, her husband.
Oh, you did a bait and switch. I'm sorry. What is your name?
She switched me over.
Okay. What is your name?
Barry.
Barry. Okay. All right, Barry, you ready?
Yep.
All right. What is the 11th century? Who is the 11th century noblewoman who rode through town naked to protest her own husband's tax increase on his tenants? I'm not going to even give you not going to give you a choice. You're going to have to come up with this yourself. The name is the name of a chocolate, a very famous and very fine chocolate. Does that help you?
Lady Godiva.
That's correct. Very, very good. Which president started the practice of releasing his tax returns? And I'm going to give you some choices. Franklin Roosevelt, Richard Nixon, Harry Truman, or Lyndon Johnson?
Lyndon Johnson.
That's incorrect. President Nixon is the president who started the practice of releasing his tax returns. And if you go to taxhistory.org, you can actually look at the president's tax returns over the years. So if you're very interested in that. When did the checkbox for the presidential campaign funds contribution first appear? 1943, 1953, 1963, and 1973? When did that checkbox first appear?
I'm going to say 73.
That is correct. Very good. You're 2 for 3. What is the first recorded instance of taxation and where? This is going to be very hard for you. I'm going to say... I'm going to give you the answer. This is too hard. It's mentioned in the Bible, but it goes back to 4500 BC in Mesopotamia. They were taxing people even back then. That was unfair. What famous band had a hit record with a song about taxation?
Famous band that had a hit record about taxation.
Famous band, the Fabulous Four, had a hit record with a song about taxation.
Oh, the Beatles.
That's correct. And the song was called The Taxman, the 1966 album. How many states in the U.S. have no personal income taxes at all? What would you guess? How many states?
I would guess 3.
It's 10 states. Some of them have no, those have no personal income taxes at all. And actually, Alaska actually pays you some money every month just to be living in their wonderful state. Tax day brings A, more suicides than any other day, B, the most traffic accidents, C, more bankruptcy filings, or D, there's no D, just A, B, or C, more suicides, more fatal traffic accidents, or more bankruptcy filings. Pick one.
I'm going to say traffic accidents.
That is correct. Tax day brings the most. That's even more than New Year's Eve. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that is.
And let's see. That really wraps it up. I'm not going to give. These other ones are really very, very difficult. What tax led to the famous Boston Tea Party? That was the Stamp Act, where there was a tax on every single paper, and that created the big fiasco of the Boston Tea Party. But you're going to get a valuable prize. I'm not sure what it is yet. Ben, have you been shopping for the valuable prize? No, he's not. But anyway, why don't you stay on the line? You're going to get you're going to give Ben your home address, and we'll get you over something from the Karen Conti Show.
All right, thank you.
Happy tax day to you and to everyone. Hey, you know, we have Rick Hogan. Rick Hogan is here in studio.
This is our new way, isn't it?
This is our new crosstalk. This is crosstalk. This means we're handing the baton to the next generation.
That guy was pretty smart. Who wasn't just a caller?
Yeah, he knew his stuff.
not bad.
Yeah, I give him a little.
You want to know something about me?
Yes. What are you doing?
What year did Rick Hogan ever file his taxes on time, meaning by April 15th.
You are not a good example to be given here.
Never.
Unless you got never.
Never would be the answer.
Now, you filed for extensions, right?
Yes, of course.
Okay,
I filed for extensions.
Okay, okay.
There was one point where I didn't file for 3 years because I was making no money. I was driving a cab. And I'm like, I'm not making any money. Why should I give any money to these people? And then there was a swimmer in the suburbs named John Kinsella, who was very, very famous, Olympic champion. And I read a story in the paper about him getting sent to jail for not filing taxes.
Well,
that's when I started filing extensions.
Well, that's the problem, that people think that if they don't file, right, then they don't have to pay, at least for a while. But the problem is not paying. You know, you can. That's not a crime not to pay. I mean, you don't want to owe the IRS money because the penalties and interest.
They'll come after you.
But listen, you have to file. Just file something. And if you're one of those people that haven't filed for 10 years, you hire an accountant. If you want a referral to an accountant, I will give you that accountant's name. They will go back and try to recreate
Karen,
the history.
Karen, when you hear from people like that, what is their excuse for not filing for 10 years?
There are lawyers who don't file. There are famous people who do not file.
Is there a general reason why?
I do not know. I think there's some people, I don't know if it's a death wish. I don't know what it is. It astounds me. And I have a friend who actually was a lawyer. He didn't file his tax returns and he went to jail.
Wow.
He went to jail for almost a year.
You know, maybe it's that same mindset of, I know a lot of people who never go to the doctor for a checkup.
Right.
I mean, it's one of those, it's a weird
the ostrich
thing.
You know,
how about this weather today, though? In the minute we have left.
This
weather today?
Well, tell me really fast what's on your show tonight.
Well, I've got the legendary George Freeman, jazz guitarist, coming in here. 92 years old. He just celebrated his birthday and celebrated the release of his latest CD.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Great.
And then a younger jazz guy named Chris Green coming in later. Then one of the kids who runs the Chicago Film Society that is in the process of, they gather and save and sort of refurbish ancient movies. And there's a movie screening Wednesday at Northeastern Illinois University of an old movie about the Chicago Daily News, which is really quite amazing.
Fabulous. Stay tuned for the Rick Hogan Show. And happy tax day to everybody.